This is the San Francisco Experience with your host, Jim Herlihy. Independent news commentary with a California perspective, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 9, Episode 9, Collateral Damage, The Mysterious Deaths of Marilyn Monroe, Dorothy Kilgallen, and the ties that bind them to the JFK assassination and Bobby Kennedy. In conversation with author Mark Shaw. On its face, linking the 1962 death of Hollywood star Marilyn Monroe and the 1965 death of ACE investigative reporter Dorothy Kilgallen with the assassination of the 35th President of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, seems to be a stretch. But investigative author Mark Shaw is able to connect the dots and identifies Bobby Kennedy as the linchpin. Yes, the president's brother and attorney general, Robert Kennedy, was at the center of these murders and national tragedy, according to Shaw. His thesis is not without controversy. In his well-researched book that draws on primary sources to a large degree, he establishes a credible plotline. Who is Mark Shaw? Mark is a former criminal defense attorney and legal analyst for USA Today, CNN, ESPN, among others. He's the author of 25 books. He attended Purdue University, and he's a graduate of the University of Indiana Law School. He worked with both Melvin Belli, the flamboyant and famous San Francisco attorney who defended Jack Ruby, as well as F. Lee Bailey, the renowned criminal defense attorney. He spent the last 10 years using primary sources to uncover a plausible explanation for who killed JFK and why, based on common sense motives. But starting with Bobby Kennedy's affair with Marilyn Monroe and her death on August 4, 1962, both the 1963 JFK assassination and Kilgallen's 1965 demise were all but inevitable. Even Jean Kennedy Smith, JFK's sister, wrote a letter to Marilyn acknowledging that Bobby and Marilyn were an item and that she should come to Washington. Marilyn had already told friends that she was ready to go to the press with her stories about the JFK and Bobby affairs. And she even appeared to be knowledgeable about Cuban intelligence matters, which would have been a national scandal if revealed to the press in the lead-up to the October 1962 missile crisis. Clearly, the Kennedys recognized that Marilyn was a volatile, loose cannon who could seriously damage their political careers, even jeopardizing national security. How could she be kept quiet? And who could silence her? Kilgallen knew and actually covered Marilyn Monroe and happened to write about her in her nationally syndicated column just one day before Marilyn's death, with a veiled reference to a very famous man in Marilyn's love life. Bobby Kennedy's appointment as Attorney General was controversial from the outset. Patriarch Joe Kennedy insisted to JFK that Bobby be appointed. But once appointed, Bobby aggressively went after the mafia after Joe had given assurances to Sam Giancana and other mafia leaders that they would be treated lightly by the new Kennedy administration. The mafia felt duped and double-crossed and clearly had the motive for revenge. Joining us today from his office in Santa Clara, California, is author Mark Shaw. Hi, Mark, and welcome to the show.
Well, good afternoon, Jim. Thanks for having me. And boy, you hit the key points in the book, that's for sure. So I really appreciate that. I do want to say this. You mentioned Purdue, and I hope I'm an inspiration to a lot of people that will listen to your program, because I'm not trying to be humble here at all. I was a terrible student in high school, took me almost 6 years to get through Purdue with a grad degree that wasn't worth too much, and then it took me a year longer than usual in law school. And so I'm the epitome of the guy who's succeeded somehow or another to become a best-selling author without having the background really as any sort of an academic or a scholar or anything that way. And so I try to say when I'm talking to people that, you know, never believe you can't do something, because if you believe in what you're doing, it can happen. People ask me about my all the books I've written, and wonder, did I have a lot of writing classes and go to camps and things like that to learn? And that wasn't the truth. I'm former criminal defense lawyer. I learned how to tell stories because I stood in front of juries to do that, and that was my that's my credibility there. But Purdue honored me last October by becoming the archival repository for all of my body of work, my research books, my books, my notes, my videos of my legal analysts on TV, my articles about my criminal defense days and all of that. And so the only other two major archival repository items there are by Neil Armstrong and Amelia Earhart. And so I've joined some pretty good company. And as I say, I'm not trying to be humble. I'm just trying to say to people, you know, if you believe in something, somehow or another, you can make it happen.
Well, Mark, I think you're being very modest with 25 books to your credit and this latest one, Collateral Damage, that we're going to talk about now, to your credit. I think you're an inspiration to all of us who have either the great American novel in mind or who are working on a research project like you have researched the Kennedy assassination, Dorothy Kilgallen, and now most recently Marilyn Monroe. So at this point, let's launch right into Collateral Damage and
sure,
take it away.
Well, it's most interesting with regard to that, because I've always had a sense of injustice and distortions of history and everything since I was in high school. And there's so many distortions of history out there about the three subjects of this book, Marilyn, JFK, and Dorothy Kilgallen. And I'm not the greatest researcher who ever lived, but it was all out there. And some of your listeners may say, well, why do we give a damn about this? Well, the relevancy of all this is we need to learn how to ask questions. And that's as relevant today as it was back then. We need to ask questions about everything. And that didn't happen back in the early 1960s. When Marilyn died, there were no questions. When Dorothy died, there were no questions. When JFK died, there were no questions. We just accepted the fact that supposedly Marilyn committed suicide. She didn't. That Dorothy Kilgallen overdosed on drugs. She didn't. That JFK was killed by one person, Lee Harvey Oswald. It never happened that way. So the relevancy is that we have to learn from history. Some famous person said something about that. We need to learn from history, and that's the situation here. So let me explain, because you laid out so well what I lay out in the book, kind of like a prosecutor. But frankly, and I hope this won't offend your readers, but I basically did it ass backwards. And the reason why is because, yes, I had become interested in the JFK assassination, but only after I decided to write a biography of the lawyer you mentioned, Melvin Belli, in San Francisco. I knew Mr. Belli in the mid-1980s. I practiced law in his building down there in downtown San Francisco. And I got to know him pretty well, and as I was working on the biography, I learned about his representation of Jack Ruby. And I really had some questions about that. He, as you remember probably, or other your listeners will, he was a personal injury lawyer, a tort lawyer.
Sure.
Yes, he represented Muhammad Ali and the Rolling Stones and some celebrities like that, but mostly he sued pharmaceutical companies and got huge verdicts, and he was very, very good at it. And an innovator and all of that. But I kept asking myself as I was working on the biography, how in the world did he end up as Jack Ruby's lawyer?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, what I found out was that, you know, and I knew this when I knew him in the 80s, that he had an affection for the mafia. You know, there are those people out there who love to let people believe that they're part of something. Everybody wants to be important in life. And Belli wanted everybody to believe he was part of, you know, somehow or another was involved with the mafia or something like that. One of his cohorts told me he used to tell people he was part of the San Mateo, California mafia and all of that. I learned that he went to Las Vegas all the time and hung out with those guys. But his most famous client at the time was Mickey Cohen. the Los Angeles gangster.
Yes.
And I was able to connect to then Cohen to some of those people that were involved in the JFK assassination, and kind of the light bulb went on. And I thought, you know, was Belli somehow or another part of all of what happened down there? And that was really clear to me when I interviewed one of his colleagues down there on Fisherman's Wharf one day, and I said, you know, you knew Belli pretty well. What about this whole Ruby thing? He said, well, we were sitting there when a waiter came up and said, you know, Jack Ruby just shot Lee Harvey Oswald. He said, I looked at Mel, and Mel said to me, well, now I'll have to defend Jack Ruby. And that was the real curious point of mine to looking in further into that. I wrote Melvin Belli, King of the Courtroom, and then, as you mentioned, I then stretched out that out into Belli's defense of Jack Ruby. And we won't get into that too much because all of the facts are in the book, Collateral Damage. But basically what I found was that, first of all, how he became Ruby's attorney, there was no question that you know, he wasn't qualified to do that. And I was told, and I was able to prove, that he was brought into that case by the same people that I would later learn were involved in the JFK assassination. Then he went ahead and defended Ruby with this psychomotor epilepsy insanity defense, which made no sense to him or the jury, and also would never let Ruby testify. And so, being the curious guy I was, I concluded in The Poison Patriarch, just as you pointed out, that this all went back to the 1960 election when Joe Kennedy realized they were going to lose to Richard Nixon. He called in favors from some of his mafia friends, and they helped him win that election.
Right.
And the deal was, you help us win the election, as you said, we'll leave you alone. And I have documents in Collateral Damage to prove all that. And so what happened was that Bobby Kennedy went after those guys, especially Giancana, but more to a guy named Carlos Marcello, who was a kingpin mafia guy in New Orleans.
Right.
What happened was that in April of 1961, this is when the world changed, and really changed because it would lead to the JFK assassination, Bobby threw deported Marcello to Guatemala.
Mm-hmm.
He was a dangerous man, Marcello was, and Bobby had every right to do that, but he didn't give him his rights and all of that, so he threw him into Guatemala. Marcello got back in the country, and then in 1963, as you get to the end of 63, he was going to deport Marcello again, Bobby was, and had him in a New Orleans court charged with racketeering. Well, Marcello, predictably a dangerous man, said to himself, I can't let this happen. If I want to kill that son of a bitch, Bobby Kennedy, but if I do, and that's to quote him, then JFK will come after me with everything the government has. But if I kill JFK, Bobby Kennedy will be powerless.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
mm-hmm.
exactly what happened. And that was confirmed by the Ruby prosecutor, Bill Alexander, to me, because he told me, I thought Bobby would be killed. So JFK was basically killed as a result of Joe Kennedy's actions and Bobby Kennedy's actions, and that's what I concluded in the book, The Poison Patriarch.
And hence the collateral damage. But let's just come back for a moment to the 1960 election, because that's where the nexus with Sam Giancana, Joe Kennedy, the Patriarch, and Sam Giancana is first identified. As we know, that was a very close election. JFK was running against Richard Nixon. There were a total of 68 million votes split between the two. JFK got 34 million. Nixon got 34 million. JFK had a margin of 112,000 votes.
Right.
And Joe
right.
Kennedy knew that there were two states that were in very close
exactly.
contention. One was Illinois with 27 electoral votes. The other was mm-hmm. West Virginia with 8 electoral votes. JFK
yeah.
actually won that election with 303 electoral votes. If he had have lost both West Virginia, 8 electoral votes, and Illinois with 27 electoral votes, he would have lost the election, it would have gone to Richard Nixon, and the history would have been different. But it was old Joe who apparently got Sam Giancana and his cohorts to raise people from the dead in Chicago
yeah.
to go out and vote for JFK. He carried Illinois, JFK carried Illinois in 1960 by 8,000 votes.
Yeah, and what's interesting there is, now people may say, look, I've heard that before some places and things like this, but what I do in Collateral Damage is I go back and see if I can bring new evidence, new information to the table. And I don't use reference books that are modern ones. Most all the time, I go back to books and articles and accounts and everything that took place near the event that I'm looking at. So right now, what we're looking at are things happened in 62, 63, 65. So all of the books that I reference in Collateral Damage go back that way, and I found a gem. And that was a biography of Rose Kennedy. By a very well-known author at the time, James Higham. And I read it cover to cover because I was fascinated about what Rose thought of JFK and his philandering on Jackie and Bobby and all of this and the kind of person Bobby was and everything. But when you get to the 60 election, Rose was out there, you know, campaigning everywhere. And yet they kept her out of Illinois and they kept her out of West Virginia. And basically, the author was able to show that she was aware of the bribes that were taking place, the duplicity of votes in, you know, Mayor Daley in Chicago and all of that. So, yes, that's a change in the course of history right there, because Richard Nixon, in all likelihood, if those gangsters wouldn't have helped win the election, you know, if they helped with the election, then Richard Nixon would have won. So you can just imagine, you know, I've got so many quotes out there about, you know, revenge among those underworld characters, because they have their own set of rules, as you know, James, and you cannot go ahead and double cross those kinds of people. I could just tell you a quick story about that if you don't mind, because when I was a correspondent with Good Morning America, they sent me to Philadelphia and they wanted me to interview an attorney for a mobster there named Angelo Bruno. He was the king of Philadelphia, and Mafia was trying to get into Atlantic City. So I went and I interviewed this guy, and frankly, we were surprised that he would talk to me, but he did, and he divulged some things that we thought were very strange and probably weren't going to ones he should have said. So they played that the next morning on Good Morning America, the interview. And it was just a huge hit. It was a shock. I mean, mafia lawyer talks about, you know. And so I was in Philadelphia, got a phone call. The producer said, "Mark, this is just amazing. Will he talk to you again?" So I got on the phone, and I called the office, and this secretary or assistant answered. I said, "Is Mr. Such and Such there?" And she said, and then she didn't say anything. And there was a pause. And then I could tell that she was crying. I said, "Are you okay?" And she said, "Well, I guess you don't know. My boss started his car this morning, and it blew up."
Oh, my God.
So you can't mess around with those guys. And, you know, the moment that Joe Kennedy, I don't know if people know this, the moment that Joe Kennedy was told that JFK had been shot and killed, he was sitting on a bed. He had had that stroke, as you remember.
Yes.
And he had the New York Times in front of him. It didn't have the headline or anything that kept him away. But Ted Kennedy told him, and he just keeled over and threw the paper on the floor, because he knew that it was his actions by Bobby Kennedy going after those guys that had killed JFK.
How awful. Let's come back to Marilyn. Let's come back to that weekend, because August 4th, of course, was a weekend, was it not? August 4th, 1962 was a weekend. I remember it. I remember the headlines in the New York papers of Marilyn Monroe dead. Let's come back to Bobby Kennedy's presence in California. Peter Lawford, tell us that story, Mark.
Well, the advantage I had here, again, was that I investigated Bell Eye, then I investigated the JFK assassination, then I investigated Dorothy Kilgallen. So let's just talk about her a minute, because it's her perspective of Marilyn's death that opened, you know, the window to everything I found about Marilyn. And people can read about this in the bestseller, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much and Denial of Justice, but just quickly, for those that don't know, Dorothy Kilgallen, I landed on her because I learned during the interviews on the Bell Eye book that he and Dorothy knew each other during the Jack Ruby trial.
Mm-hmm.
Dorothy Kilgallen was an award-winning journalist for the New York Journal American in the 50s and 60s, syndicated column, voice of Broadway, 200 newspapers across the country. She had a radio show with her husband, listened to by a million people a day, and she had already covered the Charles Lindbergh baby kidnapping case and the Dr. Sam Shepard case, which became the Fugitive movie.
Mm-hmm.
She was a big-time reporter. The New York Post called her the most powerful female voice in America. Ernest Hemingway, the greatest female writer in the world. You know, Dorothy had those credentials. She had the best sources. She had this incredible integrity about her. There's a photograph on the DorothyKilgallenStory.org website, DorothyKilgallenStory.org website. She's standing in the middle of the courtroom, Jim, at the Dr. Sam Shepard case and hear all the other reporters surrounding her. She had that kind of respect. As you can imagine, she was one who, when JFK died, and by the way, they were personal friends. The mm-hmm. senator had been to her home in Manhattan. They played games there and things. He knew her from social things. He also had been great to her at the White House when she took her young son, Kerry, there. I even remember the quote that she wrote in her column when he died. What I remember is a tall man stooping over a little boy in the president's library, talking to him, appraising him about the letters he brought from his third grade class. And so when JFK died, it was personal. She did not believe that it was Oswald alone, and so she marched off to Dallas. She sat in the front row at the Ruby trial. She wrote these columns, The Oswald File Must Not Close. She wrote about Ruby and what kind of person he was, and this he's a star at last at the trial. She talked about his friendship with the police department. She talked about all these things, and she was the only reporter to have interviewed Ruby out of 400 reporters there.
Impressive.
And so what she did then, where did she go after she learned what Ruby had to say? She went to New Orleans. She investigated Carlos Marcello. She connected him with Ruby and Oswald. And then she made the biggest mistake of her life, just like we'll talk about with Marilyn. She went back to New York and told everybody, listen, I'm going to crack the JFK assassination wide open. I'm writing this book for Random House. She told her one hairdresser, if the wrong people knew what I know about the JFK assassination, it would cost me my life. To the other one, I bought a gun. I'm afraid for my life and my family. And basically about a month later, she was dead. In a very mysterious way, she was found in a bedroom she never slept in, her hairpiece, her eyelashes, and her makeup on, not wearing clothes she would normally wear to bed. And so it was a very suspicious staged death scene, but there was no investigation of her death. But I was able to prove in The Reporter Who Knew Too Much and Denial of Justice that she was murdered, an overdose of drugs. They said she died of an overdose of drugs. But basically, there were three drugs administered to her in a glass, and I've pinpointed who was responsible mm-hmm. and all of that. So I've been able to get New York Police Department to look into reopening her case. But that brings us back to Marilyn.
Can I just jump in there for 1 minute? Dorothy Kilgallen, sure. For the benefit of our listeners, Dorothy Kilgallen back in the 1950s and the 1960s would be like Oprah Winfrey today, or Barbara Walters, or, I mean, she was a huge media star, as well as being a very credible investigative reporter, crime reporter, and she also had a main line to Hollywood in terms of what was going on in Hollywood, what was going on in Washington. Mm-hmm. There really is no journalist today alive who had the ins that she had. My mother was a big fan. We had a Journal American subscription at home. It uh-huh. would come out every afternoon. My mother read her column religiously. So I grew up with Dorothy Kilgallen in our house. So just for the benefit of our listeners, that's who Dorothy Kilgallen was. She was a huge media presence, as well as a TV presence, because she was on a weekly TV program. But go ahead, Mark.
But forgive me, because I left out probably the accomplishment that many of your listeners will remember Dorothy for, the ones up in age a bit, and that's her being a star panelist on What's My Line,
yes,
which was a CBS show watched by 10 million people every Sunday night. She was just amazing, and how many of my readers around the world and people who've watched all of my millions of interviews up on YouTube and everything have said to me, I wish we had a reporter like Dorothy Kilgallen, that integrity of hers today. So then, now I've investigated JFK's assassination and Dorothy's, you know, what happened to her in 1965. All of these questions from my readers, is there a connection between Marilyn and Dorothy? And I did not think there was, because you've got 3 years there,
yes.
1962 for Marilyn, 65 for Dorothy. But right away, and the book, you know, is not my opinions. It's not just what I'm saying. I have hundreds of documents in the book that really, you know, are primary source information, so that people can read them and then make up their own mind in terms of what happened. But I always had been a little suspicious of Marilyn Monroe. The headline, by the way, was Marilyn Kills Herself, Commits Suicide, all of that. And so I always wondered about that, but I wasn't going to do anything with it. But I started looking into it, and the first thing I found that people will see in the book is a photograph of Marilyn and Dorothy. And they were on the set of a movie over at 20th Century Fox, and they're both smiling and all of that. And I saw that, and I thought, oh, well, at least they knew each other. And then I found an article that Dorothy had written about Marilyn and her unfortunate love affairs with her three divorces, first to a childhood sweetheart, then to Joe DiMaggio, the baseball player, and then to Arthur Miller, the playwright, and how sad she was for Marilyn and all of that. But what really kicked in was an article that Marilyn, Dorothy had written, and it made me wonder about the whole situation, because if you're going to commit suicide, then you've got to have some sort of a mindset that is going to, you know, make you feel like that there's no hope, you know, that you should go ahead. Well, here's what she wrote. She said,
Now, this is Marilyn, right?
Yeah, this is Dorothy writing about Marilyn, all right? Mm-hmm. Basically, what she had done is she had gone ahead and looked into, you know, what was going on in Marilyn's life. And the crux of the article was that she was doing great. She was going to Hollywood parties. She was looking forward to going ahead and continuing to be, hopefully be looked upon as a serious actress. But then she said something basically that really hit me hard, and that was that she's doing well in the romantic department as well. In fact, she's gotten involved with a name that is bigger than Joe DiMaggio, and that was the baseball player who was a huge name at the time. And so what that did, Jim, for me is say, wait a minute, I just don't understand this, because this doesn't sound like a person who would looking to commit suicide. She seems to be on the upswing, and I had gone ahead and found, you know, some information to where just looked like that she had everything going for at that particular time. Why in the world would she have committed suicide? So, curious person like you. And so once I found that particular column, I really wondered what was going on. And I just kept then digging, as I do. And there were some quotes from her friends as well that, you know, she was on the upswing and everything. And so I wondered about that headline, Marilyn Monroe Kills Herself. So then I found the article that really changed everything. You know, supposedly Marilyn was found in her bedroom. She supposedly had overdosed of 40 to 50 barbiturates, phenobarbital and others. And she, you know, supposedly that was ingested within 3 or 4 hours and all of that. And I kind of wondered about some of those kind of things. But then Dorothy did the work for me. You know, when you're not the smartest guy in the room, you want to find the smartest guy in the room. In this situation, the smartest woman in the room. Well, that was Dorothy. She wrote a column that basically set out all of these questions about Marilyn's death. Why was the light on in the bedroom? Why was she found in the nude? She didn't sleep in the nude. She didn't sleep with the light on. Why wasn't there a glass next to her bed if she ingested all of these barbiturates? And so on and so forth. And they're the same kind of questions that had come to my mind as I looked at different things involved in Marilyn's death. And that led me then, as it does sometime, to looking into the cause of death. And what happened was, and I have in the book both the autopsy report, and basically at 10:30 a.m. on August 5th, 62, the day after Marilyn died, acute barbiturate poisoning, ingestion of overdose. And then I found the one that was dated August 5th, 62, in the afternoon. And basically, what did it say? It said that there was a probable suicide. Now, I asked Dr. Cyril Weck, who was one of the most, probably the most respected forensic scientist in our country, about that verdict. And he said, Mark, I've done 16,000 autopsies. I've never seen probable suicide. It's either suicide or it's not.
Yes.
And then coupled with that, Jim, that really caught my curiosity was the fact that Dr. Thomas Noguchi, and that may be a name that's, you know, familiar to people. He handled, you know, big profile cases like Michael Jackson, OJ, other ones and everything. Basically, an interview that he gave just a couple years after Marilyn's autopsy, he said, well, yes, I did make some mistake. I forgot to look, and just think about this, if you will. I forgot to look at a few of her inner organs, and I should have done with the intestines and so on and so forth, but I missed those, and when I figured out I had, I went to see if I could find them, and they'd already been destroyed. So if you can imagine, in an autopsy of one of the most famous people in the world, he made those mistakes. He was a junior medical examiner at the office, and that connected with me right away to Dorothy Kilgallen's autopsy, because I had found her certificate of death. They misspelled her name. They miscalculated when she died. There were 3 barbiturates in her system, not 1. And you know, we can talk about JFK's autopsy because it was done by junior medical examiners in Washington, D.C., yes, when it should have been done by military. It was done by military people. It should have been done at Parkland Hospital in Dallas. And, you know, it dawned on me a couple of weeks ago that if you really want to cover up a death, the easiest way to do it is to botch the autopsy. And so that's what happened in Marilyn's death. And so I knew that Dorothy, if she had been investigating that case, you know, she really, really would have focused on that. So then you get to the point, in my opinion, well, who could have possibly, if Marilyn did not commit suicide, who could have been responsible? And so I thought about that quote there in Dorothy's column, a bigger name than Joe DiMaggio, and I landed right away on who? JFK.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most of your listeners are going to remember that JFK and Marilyn had an affair. She sang happy birthday to JFK on his 45th birthday, I believe it was,
in Madison Square Garden.
And there's a photograph of them with her with both Kennedys after that performance. And they had a love affair. And so I looked into that. Well, could JFK have gotten involved with Marilyn and caused her death? But I found out there was a very short-lived relationship. Joe Kennedy put the kibosh on that. And so that relationship was over. And then I thought, well, what about Bobby Kennedy? And that opened up everything, as you and I have mentioned. And I can give your audience, it's all set out in Collateral Damage as to exactly how he had the love affair, how I proved it through this letter from Gene Kennedy Smith.
Yes.
Talking about the love affair. I proved it through a CIA document talks about the torrid love affair. And then to the point, Jim, that it says that Marilyn, according to their sources, the CIA sources, had said, Bobby had said he was going to divorce Ethel Kennedy and Marilyn and marry Marilyn Monroe. At least that's what he told her.
Yes.
And so then he dumped her. JFK had dumped her. And so you can imagine what a terrible state of frame of mind she had at that particular point. But actually, she was doing all right until she went to this party, I guess you could call it, event, whatever you want to say, up at the lodge. I know you're familiar with it,
of course.
On the border of California and Nevada. Up by Lake Tahoe. And there was Sam Giancana. There was Frank Sinatra. There are reports that Bobby Kennedy was there at one particular point. Peter Lawford was there. And Marilyn got the idea that they were going to try to pass her around. And she said to an eyewitness that I have there, she was tired of being treated like a piece of meat, and she threatened to go to the media. And when she did that, she signed her death warrant.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's come back to the actual night of her death in Los Angeles, because Bobby Kennedy had come to California the couple of days before that. And he, I think, as you mentioned in the book, he was in San Francisco, I think, on the Friday for an American Bar Association conference. And he then turns up in L.A. in the back seat of a Lincoln Continental being driven by his brother-in-law, Peter Lawford, who stopped by the police. And you spoke to the police officer who actually stopped the car, right, Mark?
Well, you know, you run into hurdles in research, obstacles, and you think, wait a minute, I'm in trouble here. Well, what I had been able to prove, first of all, was through ledgers that I found in a little-known book that was written during that period of time. Bobby Kennedy had been in Los Angeles during the summer of '62.
Yes.
The book that he wrote, The Enemy Within, about the mafia, which, you know, just made fun of them, and they're the worst people in the world, and their slick hair and all this other kind of stuff. I mean, it's just awful in terms of the thing he said. You can't and it's easy to imagine why the mafia hated him as well. But he was in L.A., and so I knew he was there, and he was actually at 20th Century Fox that summer. But he had this alibi that he was up at a colleague of his, a friend of his ranch in Gilroy, California, best known for its garlic,
yes,
south of San Francisco, and it looked airtight because if he was there, then he certainly wasn't in L.A. and couldn't have, you know, he could have orchestrated Marilyn's death from afar, but I wanted to show that he was in L.A. Well, I got a real break because I found, and I can't remember exactly how it came up, but this is exactly what I found, the 20th Century Fox Studios ledger. Before 11 a.m. on August 4th, 1962, reminder, that's the day that Marilyn dies,
mm-hmm,
a helicopter landed the 20th Century Fox Studios helipad near Stage 14. Studio publicist Frank Neal, working that Saturday morning, said he saw Robert Kennedy jump out of the helicopter and rush into a dark gray limousine awaiting nearby. Neil said he got a glimpse of movie star Peter Lawford, brother-in-law to the Kennedys, sitting inside. Mm-hmm. And then the episode you talk about, I did not talk to this man because he had passed away, but it was Lynn Franklin. He was a Beverly Hills police officer. And in his book, The Beverly Hills Murder File, which I substantiated with some confirmation, he said at midnight, and this would have been after Marilyn died, and we can get into a little bit of an idea of how I believe she died, he stopped this limousine on Century Boulevard over near Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles. He stopped him. Peter Lawford was driving 75 in a 40. He said, "Peter, how you doing?" because he knew him. And he looked in the front seat. At the back seat, there was Bobby Kennedy. And the front seat was Maryland psychiatrist Ralph Greenson. That's still a mystery as to why he was there. But obviously, Bobby Kennedy was there. And so once I knew that, then I found a source that told me that the reason that he came to Los Angeles with Lawford, they went to Maryland's home and they begged her not to go to the media with facts about the love affairs that she had with JFK and RFK, but worse, based on a CIA document I found, that she was going to talk to the media about matters of national security that both JFK and or Bobby had told her, including JFK's intention to have Fidel Castro killed. Well, as you can imagine, Jim, it would have been bad enough to talk about the love affairs. Well, for her to talk about matters of national security, that could not happen. And so what I've surmised is that she said, "I've had enough of you guys, I'm done with you, and I'm going to go to the media, and I'm going to move on with my life." After that, she had a hope that she might remarry Joe DiMaggio. Her life was on the upswing otherwise, but those Kennedys could not let her go to the media, and that's what caused her death.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's come back to Dorothy Kilgallen. Because with her investigative skills, she was, and of course, she covered the Jack Ruby trial. She knew JFK. She knew Marilyn Monroe. So she had connected the dots in the way that you've connected the dots here. Is that safe to say, Mark?
Yeah, she had. And you know, she's the only person, the only reporter I know of, at least, and I think substantiated, who investigated both the JFK assassination and Marilyn's death.
Yes.
And I think she would have gone ahead and investigated Marilyn's death further. But what happened was that, you know, this is August of 62. Well, you only got a month or so, I think it's into October, when you have the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Of course.
So she got off on that and everything. So she didn't really follow through with that investigation. But what really clinched this for me is that I found in this same book, it was called The Strange Death of Marilyn Monroe by a reporter named Frank Capel. That book had come out. It was a short book, about 75 pages, and it talked about the love affair with Marilyn and Bobby Kennedy. It talked about the ruthlessness of Bobby Kennedy, his ambitions, and all of that. And Dorothy Kilgallen would have read that book. But what that book did was scare the hell out of the Kennedys. And the proof is in another FBI document, two of them that I have in the book, where it talks about the fact that the FBI gave that book to Bobby Kennedy to look at. They say that the allegations in there, they kind of play their cards close to the table. Some of the allegations seem to be true, some of them aren't, and so on and so forth. But they gave it to Bobby Kennedy, and I was able to find a witness who said to me that when that book was about to be published, that the Kennedys were so scared of it that they not only went out and tried to buy every copy they could find, but also they asked the FBI agents to do the same thing because they did not want people to read that book. Mm-hmm. And because obviously it would have ended the careers, the marriages probably too, but the careers of both JFK and RFK, especially Bobby Kennedy. And so the fact that they were so scared of that book coming out made me realize that the motive was there. I always look at motive. I did when I was a public defender, when I was a criminal defense lawyer. I did it both with JFK's case and Dorothy's case. And Dorothy knew all that. And so I've only in the recent past been thinking about the fact that not only was Dorothy, in my opinion, going to, you know, pull the plug on who orchestrated JFK's death, Marcello, and who covered it up, J. Edgar Hoover, but also in that book she was writing for Random House, I think she would have nailed the Kennedys for Marilyn Monroe's death, and that made even a bigger target on Dorothy Kilgallen's back.
Well, Mark, in the remaining few minutes that we have on our podcast here, and I think you've presented You've presented your facts. You've presented your case. Let's come back to the reopening of the Kilgallen case and possibly the reopening of the Marilyn Monroe case. Tell our listeners about where we stand with those two cases, because New York's cold case, NYPD cold case department is taking a look at Kilgallen, and tell us about Marilyn also. This may be finally, after some close to 60 years, we may be coming close to getting a resolution.
Yes, thank you, Jim. And, you know, I have a quote over by my writing table, and basically it's a quote by an acclaimed novelist. It says, "The dead cannot cry out for justice. It is the duty of the living to do so for them." The dead cannot cry out for justice, the duty of the living to do so for them. And that's what I've done in a lot of my books, especially these last four or five, and with JFK, Dorothy, and Marilyn. First, I'd like to say that, you know, this all is... everything's about, you know, their life and times and death. But at the end of the book, I try to humanize each of these three subjects. Not only saying, listen, what did they lose, but what did we lose?
Mm-hmm.
Well, with JFK, we lost a president. We have no idea what would have happened if he would have lived. The mm-hmm. Vietnam, civil rights, all those different kinds of things. So we'll never know what would have happened. What did he lose? I have pictures in there of him with John and Caroline, and all of that. He never got to play with his children at all. Dorothy Kilgallen, she was the mother of three children. Don't know what she would have done with her investigative skills and her reporting skills and all that, but she was never able to play with those children again. And with Marilyn, the only thing she wanted in her life was to have a child. She hadn't been able to. She hoped that she and Joe DiMaggio might get remarried and she could have a child or adopt a child. That's what she wanted. She was never going to be able to do that because she died at such an early age, just 36 years old. And what did we lose? We lost that most beautiful woman in the world aspect of her on screen and everything else like that. Well, that's what keeps me going. And with regard to Dorothy Kilgallen's death, I've been after everybody in New York City that, of any authority, to reopen the investigation of her death. I first was with Cyrus Vance Jr., the DA, and they mm-hmm. worked on it for 8 months and said it was too expensive and they gave up. I went to the commissioner of NYPD, Dermot Shea, and he put me off for a while. Then I got a call from a detective at the New York NYPD Cold Case Squad, Philip Panzarella. Mm-hmm. And he told me he was going to look into Marilyn's death, and I assume he is.
Dorothy's death.
I haven't heard from him for a while, but I'll keep after him. With regard to Marilyn, August 4th is the anniversary of her death.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a letter, a long letter, and a 365-page evidence report and sent it to LADA George Gascon, asking him, for God's sakes, give Marilyn Monroe a reinvestigation of her death. Just like Dorothy, it destroyed their reputations. Dorothy was looked upon as a drug addict, overdose. Marilyn was looked upon as she committed suicide and all of that. So I haven't heard from Gascon, but I'm about to follow up on that letter and also see whether or not I can get some support in Hollywood for Marilyn getting a new investigation as well.
Well, Mark, I want to thank you, first of all, for being my guest on the show. And more importantly, I want to thank you for the dogged and determined research that you've done, both in the Dorothy Kilgallen case and the Marilyn Monroe case, and continuing your tenacious work to get both cases reopened, both by the NYPD and by George Gascon, who is the Los Angeles District Attorney. Kudos to you. You're like a dog with a bone. You're just not going to let go. And we owe you a debt of gratitude, because I think with the reopening, if both of those cases were to be reopened and new evidence were to be presented, that just might be the unlocking to the riddle inside the enigma, inside the curiosity shop of the Kennedy assassination. So kudos to you for actually taking those steps and legal steps with NYPD and the LA District Attorney to get something going in both the Kilgallen case and the Monroe case.
Well, I have to thank you, you know, for letting me be on the program, for letting me go ahead and provide at least facts that can make people stop and think about these three deaths and everything. I do want to say that a lot of the information in my books comes from listeners, readers, whatever. MarkShawBooks.com. You can get a hold of me through that site, and I get these emails from everywhere. And so if anybody knows anything they think I should know, I'd appreciate their getting in touch. But I thank you so much. I thank you for your research in terms of getting ready for the interview, Jim. I really appreciate that. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Mark, and we'll look forward to having you back again in the not-too-distant future. And for my listeners, please take a moment to visit our website, www.thesanfranciscoexperiencepodcast.com, to subscribe. It's free to do so. And by subscribing, you can listen to the past 170 episodes, you can read my book, you can send me an email, peruse my blog post, or make a comment. This has been the San Francisco Experience with your host, Jim Herlihy, reporting to you from America's favorite city, San Francisco.